Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams, and today on the show, it's Brian Tarosian. He is a professor at Wheaton College and Northern Illinois University. Illinois. There is an S. It's silent. I learned that when I was in third grade. Northern Illinois University. He's there, and he is also an expert in the field of 19th century guitar music. He plays on period instruments like the terz guitar. He's a specialist, especially with the music of Johann Caspar Merz. We talk a little bit about that. We talk about Giuliani. We get into it. It's a conversation with a guitarist who is actively contributing in the straight ahead way, making music, making additions, teaching kids. What is this guy? Okay, that was loud. I need to turn notifications off. Sorry. Do not disturb. Here we go. The show is sponsored by Richard Sage and SavageClassical.com. You can go to Richard Sage at SavageClassical.com and you can tell him that Big Diaper Brett sent you. I have to whisper into the microphone because my roommate's here and I get self-conscious about trying to be funny on this show with my roommate listening. And we're all together. Because what, like mild quarantine now? You guys are opening up the restaurants again, but it's worse than ever, and we have to wear two masks. We're getting mixed messages, even during the Biden administration. What? I thought I didn't have to listen to the news anymore. So how's that going for everybody? You guys okay? I'm getting my first vaccine shot is going to be tomorrow. That'll be fun. I don't know when my second one's going to be. What is it? If it's Pfizer, it's like 2 days. And if it's Moderna, it's like 6 months. Don't quote me on that. This show is sponsored also by rosettapodcast.com/insider. That's rosettapodcast.com/insider. You need to go there to get a subscription to learn the language of your choice for as little as $9 a month or for $200 straight up. You get access to the whole thing for your entire life. Any language you want forever and ever. $200. Who cares? Do it. But you got to go to rosettapodcast.com/insider. I don't see a cent. And I die alone in a ditch, which is going to happen anyway. Anyway, so I know that we were supposed to have Toni Morris on the show, right? The godfather of classical guitar radio here in the United States was kind enough to take time out of his busy schedule. And we talk about that during the interview. He has a kind of a strict schedule. I lost the episode. First time it's happened. What is this, 130 some odd episodes? And this is the first time I lost the episode, hence the long break. I thought I would have him on maybe a little bit before Christmas. Then I had another idea for Christmas. I wanted to have Carlos Rafael Rivera on the show for Christmas because he had a big year. If you don't know what happened with him, well, I'll get around to that. But first of all, yes, I lost the Toni Morris interview. Toni Morris may have it in his Zoom app. He has to look, but he hasn't had the luxury of time to do that so far. So I'm hoping that eventually we can get that episode out. I think he's been out of town or something. Anyway, my idea was to have Carlos on the show. If you don't know what's going on with Carlos Rivera, which you might not because a lot of you are nerds and don't own television sets. If you don't know what's going on, this guy who, you know, came on the show, supported the show. I played his music for my junior recital. This is the whirler of the dance. My favorite, maybe, composer of new music, Carlos Rivera for the guitar. He doesn't have to worry about the guitar anymore. This guy's like writing music for Queen's Gambit. And what was that cowboy show that I liked? Not Deadwood. The one on Netflix with Lady Mary. From Downton Abbey in it. What's it called? Help me out. You know what I mean? Oh, what's it called? I liked it. It's like this guy, you know, he tries to break off from Jeff Daniels, who's his, you know, evil boss, and it's all cowboys, and then Lady Mary from Downton Abbey's in it, and it's fun, and she's pretty in it, but she's not too pretty. She's pretty but gritty. what is it called? Do I have to look this up? I'm going to look it up real quick because it's going to drive me crazy. I'm not going to be able to go on with this show. Make sure you go to Savage Classical, SavageClassical.com. Netflix. Cowboys. Cowboy. Western movies. Not cowboy. Cowboy would be stupid. not Western movies, just Netflix. What, you guys know what I'm talking about? You guys are yelling at me, aren't you? Netflix Western series. Just, oh my God. These, are you seriously doing this to me? You embarrassing me in front of my friends? Just, I'm upset. No, I'm upset. I'm not asking for movies. Western series. Just help me out here. Godless. Did you guys like that ride? Was that fun or irritating? Godless. He wrote the music for Godless, too. He's doing all this stuff. He's a busy guy. He was I wanted to have him on the show to do a Christmas episode. So I kind of held out, and then it didn't end up happening. I think he's on a different plane, guys. I think we've lost him. You know? I hope not. I love that guy. That guy gave me relationship advice when I had dire need of it back in the day. Remember all that? Not having to deal with that crap anymore. Don't date anybody who doesn't want to date you. Don't try and convince someone who doesn't want to date you to date them. I feel like I was doing that for the first, 30 years of my life, and it's just, I'm done. People who only want the job, please apply. We've got, he's on the show, I think, way back when, and then he ended up supporting the show. Anyway, he's doing good things. I don't know how this came up. How did this come up? Oh, because why I didn't have a show. I also didn't have a show because of the Toni Morris. And now I've been trying to interview people, but I am so excited to come back with this guy because Brian Turosian is exactly what, the show's all about. It's a guy who's working his ass off day in and day out, in a specialty that we can all learn from. But he's not a household name, and he probably should be. Outstanding player and a real thinking artist. So I'm real happy to have him on the show. I'm happy to be back. I am going away for the summer again, so I'm going to try and pump as many of these out as possible before then. I might go away for the summer. I don't know. The contract's up in the air. We'll see what happens. Anyway, on with the show. Here's my time with Brian Turosian, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but I'm pretty sure I am. I checked with pronunciation.com, little thing on YouTube. You know where they go. Pronunciation.com, something like that, right? Pronouncenames.com, something along those lines. Let's get on with it. Here's my time with Brian. Brian, you were saying that this is your first ever podcast that you've ever done.
This is my first ever podcast, yeah. So far, it's going really well.
Well, we did. We had a problem with the time difference. I neglected to tell you Eastern time. And so we've been off about that, but that's just something that's a COVID story. That's a COVID fairy tale.
Sure, a fairy tale.
And so we're back though. We're here. We made it, and we have plenty of time to talk. And what is your experience? You haven't done any podcasts. You must have done interviews. I mean, you have a very interesting output. You have a lot. You must have a lot to say because you deal with period instruments. And anybody who deals with period instruments knows a lot about them. You've got a lot of books behind you for the people that can't see. So you've got there's a wealth of knowledge in you that we can tap, I'm sure. And you're holding up, what is that thing that you're holding up?
That's a Terz guitar. It's the head of a Terz guitar. But yes, I have a few, and I've just about one of everything. A Baroque guitar, and right within reach. Right. I've got the 10th string, the Baroque guitar, and the Terz guitar right around. And this is normal. That's, one of the other COVID fairy tales. I think a lot of us we've really set up our houses to, I had a good practice area, sure, but I've got a really much better practice area now.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. I didn't do any home recording until COVID. Now I've got all the stuff, and I moved apartments so that it's, you can't see. I've got the worst angle, but what I'm looking at is nice. And a couple, a lot of sunlight and stuff like that. So it's important. Yeah, we kind of found, and I feel like that's the way it was for the students too, because I teach a lot of kids, and they really didn't have home setups until this. They would just like sit on the corner of a bed. And all right. So, I'm sure you were a kid, you remember doing that, but it's like actually having a corner that's there with the guitar out and making sure that you are kind of set up for success in that way is important.
Yeah, on every level. Yeah, exactly. I think for some of the kids, if they the best they can with what's going on with pets and stuff, if they could leave, you know, their practice area kind of set up. Yeah. Maybe R should be in a case, especially again if you have pets around the house. But any barrier that that could be there that's going to just, you know, get in the way of you playing when you want to play. You know, there's enough already, you know, kind of pulling us away. So right. When it's time to play, you just go sit down and play. You might have your library behind you.
Yeah. And you do have a library behind you. You've got, and it's not just guitar stuff. You got a book about Beethoven. It's pretty neat. Yeah, I miss those. You know, I had to get rid of all those because I live in New York. So,
oh yeah,
the room you're in is like my entire apartment. So that I had, there's no room for. So as far as you brought up the Terz guitar. That was something I was reading about earlier in reference when I was kind of looking up stuff about you. That guitar is amazing, and my favorite thing that I learned was that everybody threw them out. You can't find the period ones anymore because they thought they were kids' guitars. So people would give them to their kids, and the kids would throw them all around the house, and then they ended up in the trash can. So they're really hard. It's really hard to find a period Terz. Is yours made by a replica, or is it a replica? It has to be. It looks really new.
It is pretty new. This is a replica. And yeah, to your point, I don't know of, and I don't know all these things, first of all, but what I know, there's no Terz guitar made by Scherzer, that luthier in particular, that exists. And as far as a period Terz guitar, I do not know of one. So
wow.
I also wonder, were they made a little less? You know, were there just less to begin with? Because it was a pro instrument. And, if we're amateur guitars, we probably wouldn't have bought a Terz. We'd probably buy a 6-string guitar. So you'd have the Terz and then the 10-string, really kind of the touring virtuosos. Mm-hmm. And then even more so, the Terz was so regional. The Terz was quite the Viennese instrument. So, Fernando Sor was quite capable at writing guitar duets, but had no interest whatsoever in using the Terz. I think that was regional. I think that was basically the Viennese composers really embraced this instrument. Especially, you know, from Giuliani, such a well-known artist using one in such famous pieces, a few of his guitar concerti. So, yeah, it is a curious thing. I don't know of any that exist. This was made by our period instruments. But there's many fine replicas. This is like my awesome 10-string guitar made by Richard Brunet, and he made 10-string, and it was such a great thing. And then a few years later, I asked if Scherzer had made if we knew of a Terz guitar by Scherzer, you know, could you make one the way you think he would have made it? So this is kind of it's a replica of a guitar that doesn't exist. We don't have a Scherzer Terz guitar, but using what he did with my 10-string Scherzer, he adapted and made a beautiful Terz out of it. Right now it's in on lute tuning. And I should say real quick, I'm sorry, Brett.
No, please go ahead.
But I know, from the start, the Terz is for third, and it's tuned to minor third, higher than the standard guitar.
Right.
So our first string is G. Now, I haven't tuned this yet today, so it's going to be a little lower than G, I'm just guessing. Yeah, it's pretty close, actually. So that's our open string, is G. So if you think the guitar is kind of like an E, the Terz is in G.
Yeah, so immediately the whole sort of character of it is very affected. Those are two very, to me, I'm very sensitive to keys, and G is a completely different beast than E.
It really is.
I mean, it's a different universe. So it's really interesting. I didn't really know that until I started sort of researching stuff. You know, obviously, the Terz and the Viennese. Merz was a Viennese composer, was he? So that's sort of your big.
Born in Hungary. 40 miles or so outside of Vienna, so not terribly far, but born in Hungary, but then active entirely, well, apart from tours, he was active entirely Vienna.
Right. So that would be like similar to Giuliani in that sense. You know, I noticed that something with this terz guitar, you have a raised fretboard a la Humphrey. Is that normal? Is that the way that they were, or is that something that your luthier threw in?
I think this came from the 10 string. This is how the 10 string was.
And look at it, it's actually raised off the board, not in a way that Humphrey did it. It's actually giving the entire membrane of the face of the guitar complete room to breathe and vibrate. It's really an interesting and a thoughtful way to approach the face of the guitar.
It's a removable neck.
Mm-hmm. And that was the case too?
I'm sorry?
Was that the case with the period instruments as well?
Yeah. The 10 string has a removable neck.
Jeez. Curiously.
And you can, what's great about that is, I don't know if this is the intent, but you can actually adjust the action a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe once every 5 years, I'll go and do that. But I think that's where this basically came from, the 10 string. I think I've seen some terz guitars where the frets are on the body, like right. The old. Like Panormos and such, the older guitars. So, like Baroque guitars, really. So, I don't think this was conventional. In fact, the 24 frets, I really wonder about that. But again, mm-hmm. we wanted a fretboard like my 10 string. And, you know, this guitar gets so high. That's where I don't think that 24th fret.
Yeah, let me hear that thing. That's just, I mean, that's untenable.
Really, a mandolin. It does right. sound, you know, when I play, I was working on some Giuliani with this, and and it was really kind of shocking. You know, I like the lower sounds.
Yeah.
And then I brought in, I started doing some of the Don Milano on this because it's in G. So it's like a Renaissance lute.
How interesting. Yeah.
The terz world.
It's really amazing how, you know, we think of that as like old timey. We think of Vienna. Mm-hmm. How cosmopolitan it must have felt to them. Because obviously you look at things like this and all these innovations that are going, these mechanical innovations, it must just have felt like the future was now to them.
Mm-hmm.
Really great time to be alive, you know, at that point. Unbelievable.
I'm sure. Could you imagine the music? Could you imagine walking around Vienna? Oh my God.
Love. Yeah, I think I would. That's where I maybe would go. Why not? You know, it's got to be a great over there.
We'd run into each other. Oh, did you see what Schumann? Did you see what Schumann wrote in the paper the other day?
What a freak! Oh,
yeah,
that guy's nuts.
He's again.
Now, as far as you know. What drives me crazy though is that these guitars just don't exist, and yet this is what Giuliani was writing his concertos for, as you said. I didn't know that. I knew that. I just did never. Maybe I learned it at some point, but you know, that didn't stick. But the fact that he wrote the concertos for guitars that were tuned a minor third higher than ours, how do we reconcile that in the concert setting?
It's the guitar parts are written in. You know, as if we're playing an E. So where it's essentially like a transposing instrument. So we're reading just like good old guitar music, but it's sounding a minor third higher.
When you play a Giuliani concerto on a regular guitar, do you play it with regular tuning, or how does that work? Not you, but in general.
Yeah.
And then does the orchestra have to tune everything down? I mean, how does that happen? It doesn't happen. We have to do it, right?
It's a little bit, it's like it's done for us. It's so great being this. It's already done for us, these genius composers. It's already, basically it's in the mix. It's kind of like using a capo. If you read, okay, I'm reading without the capo, it's an E, great, I'm going to put the capo on now, right. And I'm going to read as if I'm still playing an E, but it won't sound an E. But to be sure, the Opus 30, the first concerto of Giuliani, was a standard guitar. I bet he didn't have a guitar yet. He was coming from Italy and early 1800s. He's just making a name in this. How did he write this magnificent concerto? And that was not for terz. And also, I have a feeling he played Opus 65 that day, too, which is also not for terz. So curiously, I think that also... That's a case to make that Opus 65 was an earlier work. Okay, that's another story. Then he wrote the guitar concerto Opus 36, which used a terz guitar, and Opus 70, which used a terz guitar. There's a fourth concerto, which is lost. I can't remember if he says that's for terz or not. So so basically we'd be playing, let's say the concerto is in, I better do this right. Let's say the orchestra's in C. The guitar, you're playing in A. The guitar is A.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we'll sound in C. Yeah, we'll sound in C.
Right. So what's written for them is still written for, anyway, I mean, yeah, well, the terz, you can't, in other words, you wouldn't play a terz concerto with a regular guitar and the orchestra.
No, you'd have to use a capo, right. And there would probably be some high playing that's going to be pretty laborious, but I would do it in a second.
So, yeah, grab yourself a terz though from, and you said Brun, you're the maker that you work with most is
Richard Brunet,
yeah,
genius luthier. Yeah. He was in Evanston, and Ann Waller, when I was at Northwestern, introduced mm-hmm. me to him, and his shop was really near school, so it was a great place to go get strings and just get in a time warp. These beautiful guitars he had there, and very generous with his time, and taught me a lot about guitars. And as time went on, I really like that Merz music, so I approached him to do the 10 string, and he was pretty excited about it. And I'm sure it was a bit of a pet project. I don't think it was quite a job to make such a guitar like that. Maybe the first. Well, I don't know who's. I don't know many people before him who might have made one.
Well, and you're approaching him as a student then, as a grad student. You said this is at Northwestern.
No, Richard is Richard Brunet. He's been a luthier since I think the early 70s, and he's right. He had a shop in Evanston. You know, all the great guitarists used to go. He's, you know, associated with Segovia and Pepe Romero, good friends with him, and and Ann Waller too at Northwestern. So when I was a student, Ann would have not just me, all the other students. You know, she introduced us to Richard, and as we needed a new guitar, she'd mention, oh, you know, you might see what Richard has, or also another great luthier who's passed, Ron Gutenberg, and Richard Brunet and Ann, they. You know, good friend of Ron as well. So, but basically, no, he's a genius luthier that I'm lucky to have contact with.
Interesting. So at that point, you know, you obviously you did your doctor work, and I find that a lot of the people that are really into certain periods or sort of delve into music history to the depth at which you have, you know, accomplished, generally have doctorates, and it's, you know what I mean? So it was that sort of when you decided to make you're obviously your specialist in romantic guitar music, right? Particularly the music of Merz. So was that what your doctorate was about? Was that what your dissertation is about?
That's what a lot of things are about.
That time, that period?
Pretty much everything's about. Mm-hmm. I self-taught in high school. I loved playing electric guitar. When it came to college, the only thing I wanted to study was music, and I was really lucky. My parents, sent me to school. I went to college, and I loved hearing the classical things. I didn't want to study electric. I loved studying the classical, and I loved hearing the Villa-Lobos and the Spanish repertoire, but I was really wondering I had taken piano lessons when I was a kid, and I was thinking, well, where's the piano? You know, where's that stuff? Where's, go to another class, you'd hear a student play the Beethoven Pathetique Sonata, and that just really, it just really spoke to me. So I was looking, and then, in a few anthologies, I'd see Merz come up, and then, this is really just my first or second year of undergrad, and then, at Northwestern, they have an unbelievable music library, and it was just kind of after lessons, after school was done, I'd go and just walk through the stacks and look at all the, like, just on and on guitar music, mm-hmm. and not to mention everything else. And then there was this old book about this thick and bound, and I took it out and looked very interesting, brought it home. It was Merz's entire Bardenklange bound. I guess many people had mandolin clubs, and there was a Northwestern mandolin club. Someone there must have donated it to the library around 1900. So I took it home, and so for a long time I had the actual Bardenklange right in front of me. And then I could not believe it. It was so imaginative, and the chromaticism, it really even changed the way I was hearing things. It took a while even to get used to it a little. Some of the chromaticism, I thought maybe it was just maybe. I would get headaches occasionally because I'd read through it so much. And But anyway, long story short, then I
I'd imagine so. That's what I always think about. I always think like that's every time I think about, you know, Giuliani or Mertz, that's the first thing that comes to mind. So I imagine that just having just being so engulfed in that must be for years and years and years. Yeah, must cause some headaches. Must be a challenge.
That was a very short time. And I think late at night. No, I mean, I remember I was I got home at like I used to get home around 10 or so, and I have a quick microwave thing, and I'd open the book and just play.
Yeah.
And it was just a few days. It was just, but the chromaticism was so, just kind of compelling to me. It was
really everywhere. And what's really interesting too, is, I mean, so yeah, because this really is, and this is all just dawning on me. I'm spitballing here, but basically it seems like you, like most people with this music, you're a fan of the romantic composers. You're a fan of Schumann, Schubert, Beethoven, Brahms,
Liszt.
Yeah, even Mendelssohn, stuff like that. These things that we really, really love, but that we very frustratingly have very little contact with, and all the other instruments. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a flute, even the flutes get to play their music.
Even the flutes do. And it's like is based on it, you know, the radio airplay of right. Great classical stations. Yeah, that's what we have a lot of them.
So it's like this is really our only conduit into that world. This is our only sort of to actually play the music that was written by somebody who was actually there. And with Giuliani, certainly with his relationship with the premiere of the Beethoven, mm-hmm. all of these things. These are so it's really our only road in to that mm-hmm. world that's tangible.
But it's a pretty good road.
Yeah. Because that's sort of would be the counter is that these people aren't Beethoven or no, oh no, what do we do? What's your, I feel like you're going to respond to that a little bit.
Well, I think, first of all, no one's Beethoven. I think to understand right. Beethoven is to realize there was no one like him at the time. Yeah. And, especially the late period, even the great composers, some of the late period works took a little while to get into, but no, it's a funny thing. I mean, as far as inroads into it, I think there's just one funny thing, and then one I hope
one not funny thing.
It's more of a modern thing. Maybe I'm wrong about this. Maybe I'm just being optimistic that the guitarists and lutenists are kind of an outsider, and I kind of dispel that. And we can look into history and say, well, Gregory Howitt was one of the most he was the highest paid musician in Praetorius's court. Okay, there's the lutenist, right? Again, John Dowland, all of the laurels he had. Sylvius Leopold Weiss, the highest paid musician in his court. Mm-hmm. Giuliani associating with Schubert and Beethoven. On and on again, we keep seeing the guitar as being a major part. The Gautiers, the lute dynasty, informing Baroque keyboard playing by the steel brise. So guitar and lute has been at the forefront of music. And if you think of the 20th century, you'd have to include popular guitar. And I think that would continue on. Certainly before the electric guitar, the first half of the 20th century, completely by a Segovia bringing the guitar. If we were in a record store and way back, I mean, Segovia records would probably be some of the top selling ones. And so again, guitar being at the forefront. So I know it's a little bit, I don't know what we can do with that really. Then the other thing is but I think it's true. I think it's true. And I think guitarists we shouldn't accept that we're kind of tangential and on the side. I absolutely don't think we should, we're often we could be kind of sometimes even a leader, not me,
right.
But
central. Yeah.
And then I think there is a great 19th century guitar repertoire. I'm curious why it's not done much. But I think there is so much that needs to be researched. And just in just for example, Ferranti, just to name one, Cost, to name two. so many great artists. And I think if everyone kind of, maybe look at the Boije collection, Boije, the Swedish collector. There's so many PDFs, and just click if it's like, who's this composer? And you see all this really ripping stuff. I think one reason is it's kind of tough to play the music. Some of the pieces are pretty long. And but audiences love. And I think it's important work we really need to do. We really need to get into the other 19th century composers. For example, at Northeastern a few years ago, we had a thing where all this, I'll try to do a thing where all, like this year, we're doing all the Kuruli preludes this semester, right. Where the whole, including me, we all do something together. And that year was all the composers associated with Tárrega, but not Tárrega, predecessors to Tárrega. So we hear about Julian Arcas, and sometimes it's played, and Jose Vinas, and some of the others. And so they all researched some of the tangential to Tárrega, the predecessors to Tárrega. And it was a really good project. A lot of nice pieces came out of that. So I think we do have a nice repertoire that still needs to be explored in the 19th century.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, and that's always been, I know with pianists is sort of a question. Glenn Gould wrote a book, and in one of his chapters is called Should We Dig Up the Old Romantics? And looking behind you, you're like, yes, of course we should. You know, and
I wonder which book it's in. I've got the Glenn.
Oh, you've got, it's a white one. I remember it from when I was a kid. I don't know which. Oh, you're actually looking it up.
I have two white ones.
I forget which one it is. It's him sitting. It's a smaller one. Yeah, that one, the Glenn Gould reader. That's it.
Oh, great.
Yeah, a little bathroom reader. So, you know, but in that, you know, that always sort of brought up a point. But one of the things that you're saying is really true. I think that we address the Romantics at the beginning of our career as guitar students with the source studies and certainly with the Giuliani studies in the very beginning. And all these things are occurring early. And then once we get, good enough, so to speak, we end up, sorry, my levels are really high. I have to turn it down a little bit. I don't know how that happened, but these things happen. Yes, it is really high. Let me just turn that down a little bit. There we go. Okay, that's much better. Now I'm in the green. But, looking at that situation where we abandon the Romantics when we get to a certain level and we do start playing more or less Villa-Lobos etudes, and then we end up, by and large, sort of what's in vogue is to play new music. And not just new avant-garde music, but to commission works and stuff like that. And that seems to be where a lot of our focus is. And I agree with you. This is sort of our foundation. And then we sort of go, okay, well, I'm a good enough guitarist to play Villa-Lobos now. I'm going to go do that. I'm going to go do Barrios. I'm going to go do what I grew up wanting to do. I'm going to play some Sergio Assad, all these other fun things. It seems like with you and with just a handful of other guitarists, Doug James, all these, it's become a mission to explore these things. And I think it kind of has to be because, as you said, just like the piano music, these things get very difficult to play and they require a certain amount of mastery, which you certainly accomplished. But it's like, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that as far as like the fact that it's just not in vogue to play music outside of Giuliani or Mertz. Mertz would be, I would consider, a pretty popular composer. But how do you think we can address that?
Well, it's really curious. I think, first of all, and you were saying this too, is I really think you've got to play what's in your heart. You've got to play, you've got to be yourself. And
that's
this
true.
Isn't
yeah.
music,
yeah.
right? But for sure with music. And I think, as I said about barriers for, to set yourself up to practice, there's enough already with music. You really have to do, we have enough challenges. We have enough, the rewards are so great though. If you're playing a piece and you might be dreading it a little bit, you should drop that piece. There's such a massive repertoire we have. And I tell my students this all the time. If I remember assigning a piece they don't like, tell me right away and, give it a chance.
Right.
But so I think you really got to play what's in your heart. And that's where this came from with me. That's why after it's been quite a few years and, I'm so happy. A few really nice players have said before, that they could tell I'm not sick of it and I'm still so I'm not tapping myself on the back. I really get to play what I love. I love playing what I play. And you'd think I'd get sick of it already. You'd think
Well, I think one of the things that you're doing is you're exploring new instruments too. You're not just playing it, you're finding new ways to play it for you, ways that you haven't done it with. And that explains, you know, the multitude of instruments that are, you know, sitting behind you and stuff like that, right? I mean, you're not just sitting there with one guitar playing Giuliani all day. That would drive you, that would drive anybody crazy. Can't do that.
I mean, I mostly do. I mostly just that 10 string, it's the Brené 10 string.
Yeah.
And you know, all the stuff, you know, since I don't want anyone to think that they can't. I played all this on the standard guitar, and it can and should be done. And look at, you know, many great concert artists playing. David Russell's done a lot of this on a standard guitar. Mm-hmm. But as far as it being a mission, it's at this point where I'm at now, I want to get everything out. I want everyone to I'd like to kind of share anything I have, all the merits that I have, and I want everyone to kind of see this. So there still are some pieces I haven't written about that I'd like people to get out in the forefront. So it is a bit of now it's becoming a bit of a mission.
It's a mission, but it's a mission of love and of joy, not a tenuous mission.
You know? Yeah, and it's like a responsibility too.
Yeah.
You know, if I had, because, I'm really lucky. I've been able to pursue this.
Right.
And it's kind of, I fell into a stream of something, which this is really just feels like who I am. And now I want other people to, I'd like a lot more people to share it.
Yeah, well, that's important. Well, hopefully, we're going to be reaching out to people through the show.
That's another good point. Yeah.
I really did enjoy when I finally did, you know, get into your work. I was really excited because the instruments do draw people in, you know, and that is interesting. So let's talk a little bit about that. You mostly play a 10-string Brené.
Mm-hmm.
And just looking at that, that is an instrument of the period then? And what can you tell us a little bit about how that came to be? Because these are magnificent. I mean, nobody's going to mistake this for a children's guitar and throw it away, which was a problem with the Terts. But you've got four drone strings, meaning that you are not going to fret those for the people that are listening that don't know what I'm talking about. A drone string is a string that you attach below the other six strings, and then you hit it with your right hand and it produces a sound that's consistent. So you're not going to fret it with your left hand. You're going to leave that to the other part of the neck. So it looks like a double neck guitar like Jimmy Page would play maybe to some people, but really a drone is very different because you're not going to depress the string with your left hand. So go ahead and tell us a little more about that in relation to the period that it comes from and how it came to be.
I think the funny thing about you're saying about the drone, a great way to understand the drone strings, and it took me years to realize this, by the way. This guitar, in all of its magnificence, only gives you four more notes.
That's what that's okay,
four more notes. So there's still a few, for example, the first lute suite, you know, it'd be great to have a D sharp and a D, but oh no. And I mean the E minor, the 996. Like you're saying, Brett, we have the standard six string ends its own neck on a low E, of course, and I'm pretty much in tune, I think. So there's our low E, and it goes down by step from there, D, C, B, and A. So that 10th string is an octave lower than our 5th string. Notice the way Merritt starts Pianto della Monte. He kind of celebrates the fact that he has a few A's.
Yeah.
That's just the open 10th string ringing. And then if you want to be in drop D tuning, no need. You have a low D. It's actually, you still need drop D tuning. There's so many
other, but you got another drop D. You got double drop D. Yeah.
Often there's a few pieces I play where you're in drop D, you have two open Ds then. And this one does sound a little clearer because it's a little tighter of a string. So yeah, an octave lower than our fourth string. But so the bass strings is a important development, I think, really, as the piano was developing the in such great popularity, that the guitarists wanted the increased range. So we see 7-string, 8-string guitars. There is such a thing as 9-string guitars, and then even 10-string and 11-string guitars by the end of by the 1860s, 1870s or so. And so, yeah, use for the professionals use these. Mertz had, it appeared that I think he had at one point an 8-string guitar, maybe a 9 and a 10-string guitar. At one point, certainly towards the end of his life, he did have at least one 10-string guitar. Other than that, the guitar, they have 24 frets on this. So they did, again, looking to increase the range. Mertz never used the 24th fret that I know of. The highest note he ever used was the 22nd. There's only one piece that uses it. Mm-hmm. So you don't need the upper frets, really, for Mertz's music, except that one piece, evening harmonies. That's about what else should I say, Brett?
No, that's perfect. I think it's great. And what's the scale on that in relation to a regular guitar? Like as far as not the scale of the neck, you just talked of the 22 frets and the C sharp, but as far as like the actual body of the guitar, how does that relate to it looks like it's, I don't know, like a third bigger. What would you say? This is a terrible thing for me to discuss on an audio podcast, but I think we're getting the point across, and maybe I'll even release the video if you're comfortable.
I would say, yeah, the body is a different dimension. Yeah. It's a little hard for me to exactly say how different it is in the Spanish. Like this is more rounded here.
Right.
But I don't think anything terribly significant to it.
Yeah, it looks like a regular guitar, except the bridge looks twice as long.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And actually, you got it. Just one. I got it. Hang on one second.
I'm here.
This will be worth it.
I'm here. I'm sure it will be. Let's take a look.
So Richard made it's a one piece saddle.
Okay.
Oh, you can barely see that, can you?
Wow.
And it's stainless steel. So just might be interesting for the players out there. Stainless steel saddle. I had never seen one before.
Richard, yeah, I would be very frightened of that if my luthier put a stainless steel on.
Try it out. I think you get more sustain.
Wow.
I think strings roll. They ring a little more.
Yeah.
And Richard didn't think so. He didn't think there was a big difference to it. Mark Maxwell, Ann Waller, Mark Maxwell. I can't remember which one of their guitars. They have so many. Then they had one came. I can't remember which. But they had a stainless steel bridge too, and they had some of the similar things that you feel. So, just a curious thing. I love all the little
all these. Yeah, exactly. These look at that. I mean, look at that design too. The way that the two headstocks are brought together with wood, mm-hmm. To sort of keep them. It's a stability. It's really beautiful. What an interesting thing. Wood. Bent. How did he? So bent wood. He must have made it wet and then made it dry. Right? Is that how you do that?
He had a press, and there was steaming.
Yes, yeah.
And a lot of positive thoughts. No, he had I don't know how he did it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's it. What beautiful instruments. And how much do you get inspired by these instruments that you're playing? I mean, just, not just by the music, but you have a multitude of things that you can go to for inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is your period. Especially what?
It's especially the music. It is especially the music. Especially. These are the vehicles to make that come out.
Do you ever use these things to play new music, or do you ever commission works? Have you ever played music by new composers that are written for these 10-string guitars?
No, I haven't. I've done, I'm luckily tied in with school. New pieces come in. I love doing them. And I know I'm forgetting something. Something's kind of tweaking my ear right now that I'm forgetting something that I should mention it. But the steel string, the harp guitar, which usually has 12 or even more strings, there's some great players of that instrument. They compose, and it's a little in a more modern style, more of in a folk style. And one in particular, Stephen Bennett, I transcribed a few of his because he has more strings. And really sweet. Uh, That's not Maris.
No, that's definitely, and I think it lends itself, you know, the drone does sort of lend itself to modern music.
Exactly.
So that's what limitless. As far as, you know, your role as a teacher, what kind of students are drawn to you? Are they local, you know, in a lot of cases, are they local to Illinois? I know you're in Illinois. Or is it Indiana? You're in Illinois, right?
I'm in Illinois, and it's Northeastern is not too far from Indiana. Over the years, I've had a few, but mostly Indiana. And believe it or not, some students from Wisconsin have come.
Right. So generally speaking, I mean, you're probably preparing your students to play music that is not this music.
I don't know why, but it's not too many of my students study Merritt's with me. I don't know.
I think Merritt's is very challenging. I think you really hit on something earlier in the interview, is that a lot of this music is intimidating. It's just so fast, and it's really, it's by the time you can play it, you might be on to something else. You know what I mean?
But I wonder if that's also a good line that I say. Well, why doesn't anyone else play that piece? Because it's really hard. Yeah. It does sound kind of.
It is really hard.
I'm joking, yeah. Brad. There are these are really time consuming, and to play one of these, like to play some of these opera fantasies from memory. Yeah. I hear myself saying this, and it's like such a joy to do it. It's not a problem at all, but it's a challenge, that's for sure. But I love the challenge. But so I think that is the kind of commitment to do, you know, one of these 10 minute 19th century fantasies from memory. Yeah, it is a lot of commitment. It is a lot of work. It does take a pretty high level of technique.
I mean, I'm overjoyed with this conversation so far. But as far as your beginnings of you know, with the instrument, you said you started out as a rock and roll guy, just like most of us. You know, that were born before 2002. You know, now it seems like that everybody's kind of starting much more younger. But I think for my generation, I'm 44, so a lot of the people that I went to school with didn't read music when they were kids and stuff like that. I didn't when I was little.
No, me too.
So, coming from that, what was sort of your initial attraction to the instrument?
I would just think the music. I remember. One of my earliest memories, we went to a friend of the family, essentially like our aunts and uncles, you know, but friends of the family, so close, great friends of the family. And so regular thing. And we'd go and they had a beagle. We'd play with the dog. And I have two brothers. And then there was one time I saw there was a guitar in the corner. And so I didn't play with the dog that day. I played with the guitar. And just messed around. And then after dinner, I said, I'm going to play a little concert. And I think I did a little, there was some smoke on the water. There was a little, Mary Had a Little Lamb. And honestly, that the interest began. And then my parents, my cousin actually got a guitar. And I wasn't like I was practicing and doing a good job. I was really just having fun and playing air guitar. But by high school, that was pretty much all I wanted to do. I was really just sitting in my room playing guitar. And Steve Howe of Yes, there were many. You were in the 70s. There were some players who were really, they were great rock players. Yeah, but they played many styles. So Steve Howe would do classical like things, and you know, just kind of really took me to other places.
Isn't that cool? You know, I think we kind of take for granted the importance of those guitarists like him and Jimmy Page and
Blackmore,
Alex Lifeson, all these other people.
Yeah, very awful. Yeah.
All these people that sort of, you know, kind of get kind of thrown in with like a glam rocky 70s, drugs area, you know, a Studio 54 kind of thing. But it's like, it's not really, it really must have been, a passion project for them to not just sort of bop out. And they were like, they brought that to our attention, even Metallica, you know, these people made a decision to share classical guitar with us. A lot of us wouldn't have played this if it wasn't for them.
You know, I think again with someone, I don't know, and I'm just thinking again, but positively, I guess, but with someone like Steve Howe, you'd think maybe it's a bit of a responsibility. Again, you get to this place.
Right.
And I like what I said. I'm either going to bop out with it, or I'm not going to take it to a new level. I'm going to write, you know, 20 minute compositions and all these different instruments he would incorporate. So yeah, again, I think there is a certain, it's a great responsibility to have. It's like, okay, I've got this now. I'm going to run with it, and I'm going to take it as far as I can.
Well, so what are your plans as far as any new projects, new works coming out, any recordings that have been happening during COVID? What's going on with you right now?
Right now, short term, I'd like to give another faculty recital. And I gave one in November. Usually I give one a year. I used to way back give two a year, and I'd like to give another one. So it's just really without audiences, I want to play. So I have a program of music I'm working on for possibly, I haven't got the date accepted yet, February 23rd. Mm-hmm. And that would be streamed. The publisher in San Antonio, Digital Guitar Archive, DGA, Robert Caldwell down there, he has been always so great with putting out the Merits editions. And I asked him this summer, really this fall, I guess, if we can get a bunch more out. So there's some still kind of missing pieces. I have other people, we all have them, but there's not a proper edition yet. And there's about 10 pieces at least by Merits I want to get out there that are really still unknown. And he also wants to do a proper version of my dissertation, I guess, so people can kind of see where these pieces came from. So it's time. I wouldn't mind sitting around playing guitar for the next few years, but I really need to do that editing work. That's kind of the response. And I'm going to enjoy it. It's going to be great. I'm going to do a good job with it. But it's that's kind of been it's just, again, that responsibility. I really need to get that music out there for whatever comes of it. It's just, it has to be done.
Well, so Thanks for staying on top of this on behalf of all of us, because, you know, these things, it's, you get into these positions, you can get into a position of comfort, maybe, you know. I'm not going to say that you're, super comfortable. I'm sure that there's always challenging for anybody in this line of work, but, you know, thanks for going out there, because I know nobody is you know, necessarily, this is a passion project.
It's a labor of love.
So, you know, I appreciate everything that you've done for the instrument, and I hope that people will continue to support you in these endeavors. Well, Brian, thanks so much for your time, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. I don't know what it's like. It was flurrying snow here in New York, and now it's now it's stopped and nothing stuck. So we just have
at the end of a snowstorm. And I got to tell everyone, you know, we're really lucky that, you know, in our profession, we can go online, we can still teach. And
right.
In March, we went online here, and okay. And then we had a faculty meeting in April, and I told the faculty, I said, you realize we'll never have another snow day again.
Right.
There's forever a snow day. So today, school is closed, but they've gone remote entirely. So, in other words, you have to do it. Exactly. But that's what we want.
We want to continue working. Well, thanks so much, Brian.
My pleasure. How nice to meet you, Brett. And thanks again. I'm really happy to do the first ever podcast.
All right, guys, that's it for my time with Brian. Thanks so much for listening. Next time on the show, it is Berklee School of Music head of the guitar department. We've got Kim Perlack on. Finally, I went to school with Kim. She was getting her doctorate when I was getting my undergraduate. So it's going to be fun to talk to a friend. I'm actually talking to her on my birthday, which is February 5th. If you want to donate to the show for my birthday, give me a birthday present. February 5th, it's brettwilliamsmusic.com/donate. /support. BrettWilliamsMusic.com/support. All right, thanks so much. See you next time.